Please turn tonight to Genesis chapter 47. Genesis chapter 47, and we're picking up the story tonight at verse 27, and there is something that I told you that I was not quite sure about last week, and I'm happy to report to you that I am much less unsure about it this week. So I'm more sure than I was, but the verse that stands before us in verse 27 seems to be an extremely important verse in Genesis 47. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it, and were fruitful, and multiplied greatly. That seems to be a contrast to the previous paragraph. And that paragraph, as you know, was about how Joseph saw to it that the people were fed, but he did not feed them for nothing. They did not get free handouts. They had to buy food, and then eventually they had to give up their land in order to obtain food when no money was left. And eventually they worked themselves for Pharaoh as his servants, as his slaves. And you remember that in the middle of that paragraph in verse 24, it says, at the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own as seed for the field and as food for yourselves and your household and as food for your little ones. So there got to be a 20% tax as the land of Egypt was essentially turned into a nation of sharecroppers. But there seems to be a direct contrast with that situation in verse 27. Because the land of Goshen was, while part of Egypt, was a different area from Egypt. And it seems to indicate a tremendous dichotomy, because it says that Israel settled in the land of Goshen. They gained possessions in it, or acquired property. In other words, they did not give up their property, unlike the rest of Egypt. They actually were able to acquire property. They were fruitful, and they multiplied greatly. They remained free, apparently, because they were able to pay for the food. And they, their subjugation as slaves did not actually start at this time. When did it start? It actually didn't start until about 300 years later, did it? When they multiplied so much that they were considered a threat to the Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And so they were, the Egyptians set taskmasters over them and tried to control them. As you turn for just a moment to Exodus chapter 1, you see in verse 8, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. in this period that we're talking about where Joseph is in charge, no one had to be a slave unless they couldn't pay for food or had no land to barter for it. But that did not seem to be the fate of the Israelites in Goshen. They were blessed. It may very well be, from what we read earlier, that Joseph himself supplied the money that they needed, because it has told us that Joseph was going to provide for them. So, just before we leave Exodus 1, verse 7 says, "But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." Well, that seems to indicate that this multiplication that we're reading about in Genesis 47 continued on for the 400 years that they were there. As a matter of fact, if you'll remember, we read that 70 people came into Egypt. Anybody happen to know about how many left 400 years later from in the Exodus? It was over a million. Ben is giving V for victory up here. That he means by that, he means 2 million. Yeah, exactly right. 600,000 men, not counting women and children. So exponentially, they had increased throughout these 400 years from 70 to over 2 million people. So they were indeed fruitful and they multiplied. Let's take a moment to think about those phrases for just a moment. If you'd like to go back with me through Genesis, look at Genesis 1:28 again. We talked about this last Wednesday night and also mentioned it on Sunday morning. And that is the command that was given to Adam and Eve, the first two human beings bearing the image of God, to be fruitful and multiply in Genesis 1:28. God blessed them. God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." This is what is known as a creation ordinance, and it applies to everybody. And as I pointed out Sunday, we're all in the Adamic covenant. We're all recipients of that covenant arrangement with Adam, in that there is a creation ordinance for us about multiplying and having dominion over the earth, known as the cultural mandate. And there is a creation ordinance about labor and working. And there is a creation ordinance about marriage. And it is to be the covenant of companionship between a male and a female. Now, many Reformed theologians argue that there is a fourth covenant creation ordinance, which you did not hear me mention on Sunday, and when the appropriate time comes, we'll see if it's there. But many Reformed theologians have said that there is a fourth creation ordinance, and that is keeping the Sabbath day. But in any event, there are at least indisputably these other creation ordinances, and they apply to every human being. Well, they were not rescinded after the fall. Instead, what happened was, of course, like everything else after the fall, they were perverted and twisted. And therefore, they still apply to human beings, but they have been, to a certain extent, thwarted and, as I say, perverted. And here's the reason we know. Turn over to Genesis 6:1. "When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, The sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Now, if you want to get into a hotbed of controversy, just begin to read the commentaries on that passage. I'll just tell you who I think it's talking about. I don't think it's talking about angelic beings, meaning demons. I mentioned all of this when we looked at that passage in 1 Peter in connection with 1 Peter chapter 3. What I think it's talking about is the godly line of Seth, the other son of Adam and Eve. And so what this is saying, though, is that that godly line wasn't completely godly, of course, having sinned in Adam and having now a sin nature, that the sons of good, godly people, the sons of God, saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. No thought for whom God chose for them. And what you find as you get on into the chapter is, in verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. This is who has been fruitful and multiplied. This is who has been laboring and working and scrabbling out a living. This is who has been marrying, but marrying the wrong people. And no doubt those marriages have been, since they are sinful marriages, they have been difficult and stormy. Now, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And so the Lord says in verse 7, I will blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heaven, for I'm sorry that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah and who else? His family, his wife, his sons, and his sons' wives. And that was it. That's quite a minority. But the flood comes, and all of those made in the image of God who have sinned are swept away. And after the flood, look at what God says to Noah in Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. There's that command again that he gave to Adam and Eve. Now God, as it were, started over. And then, as Genesis progresses, of course, we read about more sin, and we read about the Tower of Babel, for example, and we read about the division of the nations, and finally you get to Genesis 12, and in Genesis 12, verse 2, God says to this man from Ur of the Chaldees, Abram, I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. But remember, first of all, he's going to make of this one man a great nation. Now let's turn over to Genesis 15, the chapter with which we started this study on God's providence. There we are that night that was so fateful in Abram's life, Genesis 15. Abram laments to God about his childlessness. He doesn't have any children, and the heir of his house is Eliezer of Damascus. And in verse 3, Abram says, behold, you've given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, this man shall not be your heir, your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and number the stars if you're able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord and he counted it to him as righteousness. And there's the great text that tells us when Abram was justified by grace through faith, the text that Paul uses to speak of how apart from works, apart from ritual, apart from law, apart from anything else, Abram believed a fantastic sounding promise. He hadn't even had one child left, and God said, look at all those stars. You're going to be the father of such a seed. Well, as you go to the last part of that passage, you remember that in verse 13, there's that promise that takes us to the time that we're studying. Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. Now, if you turn a page or so to Genesis 17, in verse 2, well, start with verse 1. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you, and may multiply you greatly. Remember, he now has had a son of his own devising. It is Ishmael, born to Hagar, Sarah's handmaiden, Sarai's handmaiden. But what God says here in verse 5 doesn't refer to Ishmael. He says, no longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, father of many. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations, and I will make you, again, exceedingly fruitful. And I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you, and so on. And in verse 8 he says, I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Well, as you skip down to verse 17, God has just promised that Sarai will have a son. And Abram fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old? So Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child. And Abram said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Why don't you just take Ishmael and make something out of him? You know. God said, no. Actually, in Hebrew, he says yes there. But it's translated as no most of the time, because what he's saying is kind of like what we might say to somebody, I hear what you're saying, but that's not the plan. I hear what you're saying, but no. So God says, no, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. Look at verse 20. I'm going to multiply Ishmael in verse 20, but in verse 21, I will establish my covenant with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this time next year. Well, there would be only one son through whom the covenant would be fulfilled. If Abraham expected that he would just have a great multitude of sons, and then this star-like bunch of descendants would begin, or the sand of the sea descendants would clearly start, he was absolutely wrong. He had one son, Isaac. And so if you turn over to chapter 26, look at what God says to this one son in verse 4. He says to Isaac in verse 4, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and will give to your offspring all these lands. Well, by that time, Isaac had How many kids? Do you know? Two. He'd had two, Jacob and Esau. And that's all he ever had. And neither one of them looked very promising. Do you see how the story is emerging up until the time of Jacob in Egypt? That even though Jacob went on to have 12 sons, this magnificent promise of being fruitful and multiplying just hadn't happened all that much. That is one of the interesting things about this fact, the way God works, isn't it? Because these promises were made, and yet years are going by, and generations are coming and going, and the promises don't seem to be being fulfilled. Genesis 28, verse 12. Jacob has... I'm sorry, look at verse 3 first. Genesis 28, verse 3. Jacob has come in, and we may not admire Esau for selling his birthright, but we don't admire Jacob very much for stealing it. So he's come in, he's received the blessing from Isaac, and as he is about to leave, because Esau wants to kill him, look at what Jacob says to, look at what Isaac says to Jacob. Verse 3, God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may become a company of peoples. May He give the blessing of Abraham to you and to your offspring with you, that you may take possession of the land of your sojournings that God gave to Abraham. So, off goes this deceiver, Jacob. But Isaac is trusting in the promises of God. He remembered the prophecy that the elder should serve the younger that was given to Rebekah, and he gives this prophecy to Jacob. Jacob is one lone guy in the night headed toward Haran, and if you look now at Genesis 28, Jacob lies down to sleep in verse 12, and he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it touched to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it, and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south, and in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now think of the history up to that point. Abraham has only had one son through whom all these promises were going to be made, and that's Isaac. Isaac has had two, but really the whole thing devolves on Jacob. It's Jacob, not Esau, who's going to carry on these promises. Jacob is on the lam. Here he is lying down, camping out in the middle of the night, and God appears to him and reiterates this utterly fantastic promise. So what you have here, even with the 12 patriarchs being born to Jacob, is one of those divine delays on the part of God in fulfilling this promise. And if you and I were writing the story, we wouldn't have written it like this, but that's so often the case in the Bible, isn't it? Instead, God comes and He begins to fulfill those promises, not in the land of Canaan, but in the land of Egypt, in a place of paganism, in a place of complete difference in culture from what these shepherd people are used to. And God begins to fulfill the promise of their being fruitful and multiplying greatly. So it's a fascinating passage when you think about all that has gone before it, and you think about how promises of God are being fulfilled in unlikely circumstances. Have any of you ever had God work in your life through unlikely circumstances? Through strange and unlikely circumstances? Even through bizarre and unlikely circumstances? You know, he so often converts people in strange situations. He so often ordains that events should come together so that people might be brought to him in very unusual ways. Or they might wind up in unusual places hearing the gospel. There are so many people who have been raised in Christianity, and then they've had to leave home and get saved someplace else. And then they come back and they worship with their parents and their families again, perhaps where the gospel was always preached. But yet God chose to save them in a far country or in unlikely circumstances. So it's a fascinating study, isn't it, of the providence of God. You would think that the least likely place that this promise of being fruitful and multiplying would have been fulfilled would have been Egypt. But that's what begins to happen. And apparently Jacob lived a lot longer than he had expected to. Jacob's been ready to die in our story for a long time now. And it says in verse 28, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. Let's talk for just a minute about this multiplication of God's people. First, before we talk about God's people as a whole, let's talk about what has made you stronger, more Christ-like, closer to the Lord than probably most anything else. What kinds of things do that to Christians? Tribulation. Yeah, tribulation works endurance, and endurance experience, and experience hope. And hope makes not ashamed. So many of you can say, I was changed, I got closer to the Lord because of trouble, because of adversity. It was Shakespeare who said, sweet are the uses of adversity. It was the Apostle Paul who said, God works everything together for the good of those who love Him, who are the called according to His purpose. Have you ever been through an experience where you thought, oh no, this has come just at this time. This is the worst possible thing that could have happened. This ruins everything. And then you got through that experience and you realized that it was ordained by God. I mean, it was really a good thing. That's why we studied when we got to Romans 5, where Paul says, more than that, we rejoice in our sufferings. We exult in our sufferings. And you think, well, maybe later. Maybe later, you know, when it's all over and I look back and I see, whew, dodged a bullet on that one, or I see that it really didn't turn out okay. But it sounds like Paul got to the place in his life where he actually exulted when a suffering came about, almost wondering what good thing God was going to bring out of it. We exult in our sufferings, knowing that the suffering produces endurance. In other words, we think, somehow this will be a good thing. Somehow this will bring me closer to the Lord. I would ask how many of you are able to do that yet. It's easy to do it when the suffering is over and when the good thing has been seen. It's harder to do at the beginning, isn't it? But now let's talk about how God has made His individual people multiply and become stronger. Not an individual, his corporate people, has made his people as a whole. We know he does it in the individuals through suffering. How does he do it? Corporately. Same way. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Do you remember that time when persecution broke out in the book of Acts after the death of Stephen? It says in Acts 8, verse 1, there arose on that day a great persecution against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. Devout men buried Stephen and made great lamentation over him. That's one tragic thing that's happened. Here's tragic thing number two. But Saul was ravaging the church and entering house after house. He dragged off men and women and committed them to prison. You have those two horrible things. Then in verse 4, now those who were scattered, what about preaching the word? And that's how the Great Commission began to be fulfilled beyond Jerusalem, into Samaria, and into the uttermost parts of the earth. It happens through persecution and suffering, doesn't it? Why? Why? Excuse me? We get comfortable. Yes. And? And what happens when we get comfortable? You what? You trust yourself. You forget about the Lord. What else? You say, my hand has gotten me this. You think that you forget that everything you have received is a blessing from God. You, if you have need of nothing, you tend to not think that it's God that's upholding you moment by moment. We tend to become practical deists. We don't become practical atheists, but we become practical deists. God started this process. I've made the best of it, and now look at all I have gained. But what happens? Why should the church grow? Why should there get to be more Christians in the world if you begin to suffer, or you have either your livelihood or your very life taken from you? Why might we expect the huge revival that we'd love to see in this neighborhood if all of us were suddenly to endure suffering? Or somebody were to not like one of the TV reruns and burn this building? And the church and the neighborhood would know that we have suffered a great loss. How would that help? That seems to be it. Yes, Mary?
I think now which church it was, but you probably remember several years back there were two. There was one Baptist church, and they got a real problem. And they split, and the way it turned out, God had two good, strong churches. Now that one church, okay.
yeah, that's right. And I think Brenda's point about people seeing the way we behave in adversity. What do we admire about Job? The fact that everything was taken away from him. He did not curse God and die. He said, instead, naked I came into this world, and naked I will depart from it. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And Satan said, oh, didn't curse him after all. God said, I knew he wouldn't. But this impresses people when people's faith is put to the test and they stand up for it. Stand up more visibly. Their joy overflows to others. People begin to ask, what is it you have? What is it you know? What is it that drives you? And they want to know about the joy that is in us, as Peter said they would. So, Yeah.
I've come to just my faith within the red book.
Yeah.
And William Cooper comes to the conclusion that God alone knows what to do.
Yeah.
Why we suffer, or what good is going to come of it, or how it's going to work itself out. God, and that's what we have to sort of do.
Yeah. Well, that's right, and I remember a number of years ago, I certainly cannot begin to duplicate all of this, but I heard R.C. Sproul speak in person in Austin, and he pointed out all of the chain of events that started with the beginning of our very study, that when Joseph was sold into slavery. And if Joseph hadn't been sold into slavery, then the nation wouldn't have been preserved in Egypt. If the nation had not been preserved in Egypt, then Jesus would not have been born from the nation. The Messiah would not have come, and Jesus would not have died on the cross, and so on. And so he traced the betrayal of Joseph by his brothers as the starting point here in the historical chronology about right up to yours and my salvation. So anyway, again, I can't begin to duplicate that, but the point is that the blood of the martyrs, Tertullian said, is the seed of the church. The church grew strong in the days of the Roman Empire because of persecution, because there were martyrs who loved not their lives to the death, because they stood up for what they believed, and they proclaimed it forcefully and boldly, and they lived it, and they proclaimed it with their actions. So this kind of suffering is, in fact, what so often makes the church credible in the eyes of society. One of the great evidences of that was in 1950, the church in China had grown reasonably well from the work of 19th and 20th century missionaries, but still, in all the country of China, there were about 800,000 Christians in 1950. And then, since the days of communism, the church has increased to 50 million. So it's absolutely amazing, you know, with most of the worship being underground and worship services being illegal and so on, that the church has increased that way. It's a strange phenomenon, but it's exactly what we're seeing in our text tonight, that they went down to a foreign country, and a country in which they began to be persecuted eventually, and they multiplied and were fruitful, and God fulfilled His promise. What does that tell you generally about the promises of God? They're true, and they will be fulfilled in unlikely ways and at unlikely moments. What great promise do you think of that we're specifically told will happen that way?
Well, where it said it will be at the appointed time. It won't be early or late.
Yeah, there is a promise like that. It will come at the appointed time. It will come. Do you think about the coming of the second coming of the Lord, the coming of Jesus? Because as more and more people get skeptical about it, Second Peter says they'll ask, where is the promise of His coming? And they'll say, ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation. But Peter says in Second Peter 3:6 and or 8 through 9, do not overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill His promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will pass away, and so on. So, God made this promise so many years before to Abraham, and then again to Isaac, and then again to Jacob, and it finally gets to be being fulfilled the last 17 years of Jacob's life. Okay, verse 29. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. So, Jacob prepares for his death by calling for Joseph. And he says, put your hand under my thigh. That's similar to something Abraham said long ago. You remember that Abraham told somebody to do that? To put his hand under his thigh and swear? Yeah, he told his servant to do that when he wanted him to go get a wife for Isaac. In Genesis 24. Now Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh, that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac. And along there in all of that, in verse 7, he again remembers the land promise. He says, to your offspring I will give this land. So let's figure out, you've got two different cases of two very old men, Abraham and Jacob. They're not going to have any more children. They're not going to be natural fathers anymore. And yet, they have the person swearing to them assume this position, putting his hand under their thigh. What are they doing? They are acknowledging the truth of God's promises to the descendants of these men. The ones who had come forth from their loins. And they are saying, as you agree that these promises are true, and they have been promised to me and to my descendants, then swear on that you're going to do this certain thing. And so Jacob is dying, and he says, you've got to promise to deal kindly and truly with me, and this is what he wants. He says, do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. He answered, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. And he swore to him. Why would Jacob want this? You know, missionaries who die on the mission field don't get to come home usually. Their bodies are buried in the country in which they lie. One famous exception is a part of a certain famous missionary's body was brought back to England and buried David Livingstone's body in Westminster Abbey, except for one part. They buried his heart in Africa because his heart was in Africa. in service to Africa. But Jacob is not into sentimentality here. Why is this so important? Why not just get a nice pyramid there in Egypt? Yes, it's the land promise. That land was given to him. That land was given to Isaac. That land was given to Abraham. And that land will be given to his descendants. He wants to go back and be laid to rest in the land that God has given him. And that is a way of saying, even though I am in the land of Egypt, so far away from home, that is what God has promised to me back in the land of Canaan, and I will show even in my death that I believe His promise. And so he fulfills his faith in God and in the promises of God by making Joseph put his hand there and partake or acknowledge that through the seed, the blessing will come and the land will be given. And so Joseph swears to him. And then the last sentence says, then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his, and the version you have here is very, very crucial. Because if you have a New International Version, you have the word staff. If you have an ESV, you have the word bed. Okay. You have the word bed. And the reason for this is that the Hebrew word that is being translated there, if you were to translate it, you remember that Hebrew was originally in consonants only. And so in the original Hebrew text, you had three Hebrew letters, which would be the English equivalent of M, T, and H. And so that's the way the original text stood. Well, in the 8th century, in the 700s, Jewish scholars came up with the Masoretic text. They were called Masoretes, and they came up with the Masoretic text. And your Old Testaments are translated from some sort of carefully edited version of the Masoretic text. Well, what they did in the Masoretic text was helpfully put in vowels to those consonants. And the vowels in Hebrew look like Morse code. They're little dots and dashes underneath the consonants. So you actually zigzag as you read the Hebrew words. And so it's possible to point the words differently, meaning it's possible to put different vowels and there would be a different word. So MTH, according to the Masoretic text, should be pointed with the vowels for mitah. Mitah means bed. And so you have in the ESV, Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. Let's take a look at Hebrews 11:21. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. Because you can take those same, well, first of all, the writer to Hebrews was probably using the Septuagint translation. The Septuagint translation was done before Christ, and it was done in Alexandria, Egypt. It was a translation from the unpointed Hebrew, no consonants, or rather no vowels, just consonants, to Greek. And that's probably what the writer to the Hebrews was using. So what you've got here is the word matah instead of mitah, And matah means staff, if you put different vowel marks under MTH. So as you go to the writer to the Hebrews, you find that Jacob was leaning on his staff. And this is why your ESV says, or staff, after the word bed. And the question is, how should it be translated? Well, it can look like, of course, from the text, that since he has called Joseph to come, he's probably bedridden. Joseph puts his hand under his thigh. He's at least sitting down. But none of that means that he's not leaning on his staff. And the writer to Hebrews tells us that that is exactly what he was leaning on. Now, he was probably on the bed. He was maybe even up at the head of the bed. But the image probably is of him sitting on the bed, leaning on the staff. What do you think the significance of the staff is? Well, first of all, what does our text say that he was doing? He bowed himself. He's worshiping, leaning on that staff. And this is what the writer to the Hebrews recognizes. Now, he was worshiping by exercising great faith and great confidence in what Joseph was going to do for him. He wanted to exercise great faith in God by getting his physical body back to the land God had promised, and by so doing, he was going to show himself at one with his people. He asked that he be buried in the burying place of Abraham and Isaac, and we'll look further about that next time. But you remember that Abraham and Isaac were buried in a cave. A cave at Machpelah. A cave at Machpelah is still there. And it is a sacred place for three religions of the world. For Christians, Jews, and Muslims. It's the place where Abraham bought as a burial site for Sarah, bought it from Ephron the Hittite, and he and Sarah were buried there, Leah's buried there, Isaac and Rebekah were buried there, Jacob want to be buried there too. But this is an act of worship. This is not sentimentality on Jacob's part. This is not saying, take me back to the old home graveyard. This is a belief in the promise of God, and he's worshiping God in this action and leaning on his staff. Now, what's the significance of his leaning on his staff? When do you think Jacob really learned to depend on God? He was such a trickster and a shyster and a scoundrel. He was a cheater and deceiver. And then something changed. What?
God touched his hip.
He wrestled with a man all night long and said, as the day was breaking, what is your name? I won't let you go until you bless me. He knew he needed to be blessed by this mighty being. And he said, what is your name? And the being said, why do you ask my name? Perfectly well who I am. And from that moment on, Jacob limped. He limped out of that encounter. Just a reminder of his dependence on God from then on. I think that the significance of his worshiping on his staff is that he was worshiping the God of his fathers, the God of all those experiences, the God who met him at Bethel, the God who blessed him, who delivered him from Laban, delivered him from Esau, brought him to Egypt. But he was worshiping a God upon whom he had learned to be completely dependent. It's worshiping a God, I think, who met him in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ as he was waiting that night in fear of meeting Esau. It was, I believe, the night of his conversion, the night of his regeneration. But so often, God touches us in a significant way that we never forget. Is that not true? And that's what happened to Jacob. He was dependent on God, and he bowed himself upon the head of his staff. I'm going to stop at just a moment, except I want to read the first five verses of chapter 48. After this, Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is ill." So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and it was told to Jacob, "Your son Joseph has come to you." Then Israel summoned his strength and sat up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan." That's the place he named Bethel. "And blessed me and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession.'" In other words, this is Jacob's hope. This is his constant belief. Fruitful and multiplying and giving the land to his offspring for an everlasting possession. And this is why he wants his body back there among his fathers. And we're going to end with verse 5. "And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are." This is an exciting and interesting new twist, isn't it? He's adopting Joseph's two Egyptian-born sons, the sons of Asenath, the daughter of the priest of On, who were given to Joseph by God in Egypt, and Jacob, officially, in our passage that we'll look further at next time, adopts them, acquires two new sons, and in so doing, acquires two new tribes for Israel. Strange kinds of things our blessed Lord does. And we may learn that He does all things together for good and does all things well. So we'll take up the story there next time. Are you ready, as Jacob was, to die? Will you believe God when you die, thanking Him for your infirmities, which you will realize at the time of your death He sent to you for your own good? Blessed be the name of God.